All right, let's go ahead and pray. Father, we thank you so much for the chance to come here and discuss these worldviews, discuss truth, meaning, value, and we are thrilled that we can do this tonight. We pray that you would open our minds, enlighten every part of us, help us to think critically, help us to be wise, and understand your truth so we could be better and effective ambassadors in the world around us. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. Now, without going into this in too much depth here, this first little table that you see, these existential questions, just read through these with me and see if you've ever asked yourself these sorts of questions. And then put your thinking cap on and see what it would be like for a non-Christian to ask themselves these questions and answer them. What sort of answers maybe would they come up with? You don't have to respond, but just think through this. How would a non-Christian respond to these questions? Where did I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? What is my purpose? Was I made for something? Do I have a destiny? If so, what is my destiny? Am I an accident? Does my life have meaning? Do I have a predetermined essence? Can I choose who I will be? Is my future one of fate or freedom? What do I base this on? Can I choose my own future, or is it chosen for me? So these questions are very hard to answer if you're a non-Christian. And again, this is the naturalistic framework that we're working with here. Usually when we're talking to a non-Christian, they're most likely a naturalist. So given that, and given the nihilism that comes from naturalism, like we talked about last week, the answers to these questions create a very bleak, depressing picture, kind of like we talked about last week. And so non-Christians ask these as existential questions like we do, but what are their answers in a world without God? They're very bad answers. It's very, very frustrating, I'm sure, for them. And so most of the time, they probably don't get that deep and they don't go ask themselves this stuff. And so tonight we're going to see, though, if any of their answers make any sense. We're going to see what kind of answers could they conjure up and if those answers are good. So you may hear some things on the street like this. Our destiny is within ourselves. We don't need God. Or we are not predefined souls made in the image of God. We have no essence, and we are not predetermined. You may have heard something like that. Or you may have heard, we must decide who we want to be since we have no prescribed nature. We must just figure this out ourselves. We have nothing that defines us. We can be anybody we want to be. We decide. Or how about this? There is no meaning in the universe, nihilism. We have to create our own meaning. We have to create our own meaning. Or this one, choose your own future in spite of the bleakness of the universe. So when considering the depressing perspective that nihilism brings, choose your own future in spite of that. So how should we understand these sayings and respond? So as we've been talking about, these sayings are rooted in philosophy. And in order to appropriately respond to these sayings, we need to understand existentialism. And so tonight, we're going to basically define the view, examine where this view comes from, show the criticisms of the view, determine whether or not this view stands up to scrutiny, and learn to respond to this view, known as existentialism. So just by a show of hands, how many people have a background reading existential literature, or do you know what existentialism is? Just so I know. I bet you do, yeah. A few of us here, okay. Okay, a few of us have a little bit of background in this. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and get into it as if we've never heard of it before, okay? So a little background here. Existentialism is kind of an anti-philosophy or cultural mood or an individual attitude. It's more of a kind of this feeling, if you will. You kind of jump into this ocean of existentialism. You just feel it out. So there's not some sort of analytical, philosophical syllogism that we have to go solve or consider whether or not it's valid or commits any logical fallacies. It's very different than that. So it's more of a mood than a philosophy. It takes on a very different approach to philosophy. Things come out in plays or novels, existential themes like some things we'll talk about tonight. So you kind of see the expression of existentialism more in movies, plays, and novels than you do in rigorous analytical philosophy. So it's very much a cultural philosophy. So existentialism is really a response to nihilism and accepts the results of the inevitable death of the universe and the annihilation of ourselves, but it says that there still is meaning in the universe. So last week we talked about how nihilism says there is no meaning in the universe given the naturalistic perspective. Existentialism is a response to nihilism, and it says we can create the meaning in the universe. So the universe is meaningless, but we create meaning in the universe. You may have remembered I was talking last week about a box, and we're all just stuck in this box, and there really is no way to get outside of the box. How about that cube, huh? So we're stuck in the box, right? We just can't get out of it because we're just these humans. We can't get beyond the limits of the universe. So nihilism says, remember, that nothing, no meaning exists in our universe or in our box. If you look around all over the box, you won't find anything with meaning, value, or purpose. So existentialism says that we come in and we create meaning. That's kind of the idea. Meaning doesn't come from the outside in. So just kind of a little graphic just to help you think through this. I mean, nothing too profound here. So to define existentialism, this now is very difficult because there is not one definition of existentialism out there. In fact, the existentialists usually don't even think of themselves as existentialists. They just consider themselves as novelists, writers, you know, free thinkers, cultural commentators, pundits, you know. So defining existentialism is very difficult. In fact, the word existentialism wasn't even used until Heidegger in the middle of last century. Although it seems to have appeared when you read Kierkegaard, the Dutch philosopher from 1840-ish. But existentialism as a word doesn't even get used much in existential literature. So it's a very weird sort of view. Existentialism, if we were to try to define it, is something like this. It's a humanistic view that describes our human condition and our purpose for being in this world when we face our dread, anxiety, and absurdity. And when we do face it, we can then choose to reinvent, redefine, recreate himself, herself, humanity, value, and meaning. So it's kind of a view that describes our cultural human condition or the human predicament, Christians consider this to be the fallen self, or the original sin that we inherit, or the suffering that we endure while we are on this earth. And so when we face this cosmic aloneness or alienation, not being able to discuss things with nature, let's say, have a conversation with nature, we're kind of all by ourselves. When we face this alienation from nature and we understand the dread that comes with that, existentialism says when you face it, when I face it, we can then reinvent and recreate ourselves, and we could create meaning in this universe. It's only when we face the absurdity of our existence. So based on a naturalistic framework, we experience nature operating like a machine. So it's manufacturing more nature on to infinity without regard for human life. So nature is like this cold mechanistic machine imposing on us. It just kind of is like a big tractor, and it just goes and grinds the soil, and it recreates more nature. You know, it's just this ongoing machine. It's unstoppable. And that imposes on us. We run into that tractor all the time. We get run over by that tractor. We feel this pressure from nature, this existential pressure on us. This external world has laws that just cannot be changed. You can't just go run off a cliff and expect to just float to the other side of the canyon. Gravity will always win. And we feel this inflexibility with nature. So we, in a sense, are part of this machine. Remember, with the naturalistic worldview, we're just animated stardust. Remember, we are just a product of the stars that coalesced on this planet, and the material eventually created some sort of living organism. We're a product of nature. But at the same time, we are crushed under the weight of nature. We cannot get beyond nature to master it. And we are aging, and we feel the effects of nature pushing us towards death. So this leads us to despair, because nature will always win. We all die. No one beats that. So with existentialism, we need to accept this non-being. This is a key word. I'm trying to underline and make bold the key words here for existentialism. We need to accept this non-being to pass through despair. So we need to accept our death. We need to accept the absurdity of our existence, that eventually we'll either be annihilated or the earth will die a heat death, the universe will die a cold death, all that we talked about last week. So we must face the absurd death of ourselves and this overall meaninglessness. Okay, so again, you see nihilism here. So when nihilism destroys the foundations of our world, remember how we talked about the skyscraper of knowledge and nihilism attacking the foundations of knowledge, and our skyscraper of knowledge collapses because the foundations are now gone. So when nihilism destroys the foundations of our structure, this is what we have to do. We have to make our stand against this force of nihilism coming against us. We have to make a stand against nature imposing on us and bringing us to the death of ourselves and the meaninglessness of our existence and the absurdity of life and the suffering that we endure. We have to face that. We have to look into the abyss. And until we do that, we're going to be stuck in nihilism. But when we face it, when we have the courage to peer into the powerful limits of nature imposing on us, then out of this nothingness, back to your outline, our solitude in the universe, out of this nothingness and our solitude in the universe, humans still can choose something. We can go somewhere. We can create meaning, and we could build something. So although we are alone, we still are free. And we are not just a machine. We are machine-like, but we are not just a machine. We are different. We freely can stand and freely can create against this naturalistic world imposing on us. And so this is the difference between us and everything else, is no one else can choose to do something. So when we face this absurdity, we can then do something. We can go get some ice cream. We can go watch a Disney movie. You know, we could go to church. We could go eat at an expensive restaurant. We can do something. That doing something, that acting in the face of absurdity, is the existentialist's power. It's his hope. It's his sense of creating meaning. Yes. Yeah, it kind of depends on which thinker you're learning, you know, you're studying. Some just take for granted and assume the nature imposing on them, and some say, well, nature doesn't even exist until you feel it imposing. You know, so it kind of depends on who you're talking about. It's a good thought, yeah. Yes. Thank you. Okay, we're not talking about the Christian version of existentialism, because that is a neo-Orthodox type of theology that we just don't have time to get into, because really we're not going to go try to convert a neo-Orthodox theologian who's a Christian existentialist. Rudolf Bultmann, some of these other guys, Paul Tillich, are Christian existentialists. Christian existentialism really just starts adopting some of these secular ideas and then doing theology with them. Yeah, so Bultmann, Tillich, a few others, they really became prominent in 1950s, just like some of these existential thinkers. But we're just not going to do the Christian existentialism stuff. We just don't have time.
Can you talk about
the little bit? Sure. Is everybody else okay or no? Okay. we'll work on it here. Let me know. Just keep me posted. So back to this saga here we're in the middle of. So incredibly, we are all free creatures in spite of this deterministic, naturalistic world around us. And so we can all stand up to this to the mechanistic laws of nature and take action to be free creatures and exercise our freedom. Again, these bold underlined words are very commonly used in existential literature. So in this sense, existential hope emerges. There can be courage to live another day when we stand up to the laws of nature. Now, humanity, then, is in control of her own fate. Humans are in control of their own fate. Humanity creates meaning for their being. So humans just start creating meaning for our existence. We rationalize, we justify ourselves, what we do, how we do it. So we can have hope, according to the secular existentialist, despite this anxiety and despair. There is hope that emerges in hopelessness. There is a blooming flower in the desert, so to speak. For the existentialist, this is the hope we have in the face of meaninglessness and hopelessness. And this is the meaning that we create in the face of meaninglessness. So hope, meaning, courage, choice, facing the dread, the abyss of your despair. These are big themes in existentialism. So overall, we are free and we can choose to create hope, meaning, and being in spite of non-being. So being is a big, important theme in existential literature, being versus non-being. So last week we had this little diagram, if no God, no purpose, no meaning, and then if no God, no truth, no morality. So this week nihilism turns into existentialism, and the last part of that diagram reads create meaning and create morals. So with existentialism, you come out of the abyss of nihilism and you create meaning and create morals. So here are some of the key themes and features of existentialism. We've talked about some key words. Here are some key themes and features. Humanity and his or her ultimate purpose for being is a key theme. So that's kind of what they try to focus on. What is human? What is humanity? So existentialism deals with the crisis that all of mankind faces and how mankind relates to the world and his future in light of that crisis. So we have to, with existentialism, we think about ourselves now and we think about ourselves in the future, and we start to understand our existence in light of the overarching scheme of our life and how it fits into the overarching scheme of humanity and how that fits into the overarching scheme of the cosmos. Meaning is birthed in meaninglessness, and hope arises in hopelessness. You can put the word in hopelessness there. So, like we've been talking about, mankind just is ultimately negotiating his way through a very complicated history towards somehow creating a meaningful story for himself, herself, in spite of meaninglessness and non-being. So when we look at all of humanity, we say, gosh, where is this all leading to? Are we getting any better? Is there any progress from the Egyptians and the Greeks and the ancient Chinese till now? Do we kill more people now or then? You know, how are we doing? And then another concept with existentialism is this simple idea, existence precedes essence. Okay, we're going to just put that on hold. We're going to talk about that again in a moment. Existence precedes essence is a big concept for the existentialist, but just put that on hold. The human predicament can be overcome by facing itself and embracing one's freedom to overcome the absurdity of the universe. Okay, so you can overcome your human condition of being sinful. You can overcome that human predicament by just facing it and embrace your freedom to overcome your absurdity. So there's a way to get past this Christian understanding, this foundation that Western culture was based on prior to the Enlightenment. There's a way to get past that by just embracing your original sin. And so the last theme here is that I create meaning for myself and you create meaning for yourself, and we all have an individual responsibility to choose everything. You just choose things with your life. That's what you do as a human. You just are a chooser. You walk around choosing things because you have free will. You have freedom and nothing else in the universe does. Everything else is a machine. So this choosing is radical freedom we all must do to be. So again, this concept of being and existence is very powerful in existential literature. So existentialism, in this sense, attempts to create meaning and meaninglessness and give our being a reason to justify our being. Is there a question? Yeah. Existentialism exalts ourselves. Yeah. It's not completely humanistic. It's not completely humanism, but it leads to that. So next week, or this weekend, I'm actually going to give you secular humanism, an outline. We're not going to do it here in class, but it's the next step. Is you start, then you now have to deal with the secular humanism out of this. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's very easy to latch onto this if you're non-Christian. Okay. Now this big table. Oh yeah. Question here.
Is there a direction for choosing to go towards, or is it the fact
Yeah, it doesn't matter what you choose. You can choose to kill. You can choose to come in here with a bomb and kill us all. Hey, you chose it. So you're just acting out of your freedom. Yeah, you created meaning. You created martyrs or whatever out of all of us and yourself. And I mean, that you're getting at something really important here, is that with this subjectivism that we're starting to see, where does this lead to? So we're going to talk about that after the break, because that actually becomes one of the criticisms of this view. So it's a very good thought. Yes? Coming later. Yeah, after postmodernism comes relativism. With relativism, you have this other component added to it that no one view is right and don't judge. With subjectivism, it's kind of that way, but it's not really said. You know, it's kind of like subjectivism just gets us to do anything you want, choose anything you want, but it doesn't really go the next couple sentences later. So relativism is kind of the added part of the package. But in a sense, you're right. Yeah, it leads essentially to that. So with this big table you have in front of you, why don't you just take a look at that with me here. So existentialism, just to continue to help drive this home, what it is, it rejects a whole bunch of stuff and embraces the opposite. So it rejects determinism, which comes from the machine of nature, just unfolding as it does. You can't stop nature from doing what it does. It's determined to do its thing. And it embraces free will. It rejects fate, meaning that we're all going to wind up somewhere and we can't do anything otherwise. And it embraces fate only from death. So yes, it accepts fate, the fate of our death, but it doesn't accept the fate of our life. We could choose anything we want while we're alive. So in that sense, it embraces fate of our life, or free will of our life and fate only of our death. It rejects the fear of cosmic dread. You don't have to have fear of your cosmic dread. You don't have to fear any cosmic annihilation. You just embrace the absurdity of the cosmic dread. You take that in, and you stare right into that abyss of nothingness, and you embrace that moment. It rejects ultimate being with a capital B, meaning God, and it embraces individual being with a lowercase b, meaning us, meaning individual humans. It rejects choosing based on God, what God would have for us, or what God has instilled in us, our giftings, our talents that he's given us, and it embraces choosing based on the self. Whatever you want, choose that. It rejects the essence of humanity. It rejects this idea that we have a essence. There is a human essence that we all instantiate, that we all exemplify. It rejects that. It says there's just an individual existence of each human, that humans do not carry their essence with them. They don't exemplify a universal essence. They just are individual components, and they are completely not related to the other humans around them. So there's just individuality here of existences, no essences. It rejects the false self, and it embraces authenticity. Well, we like that too as Christians, so that's not so bad. It rejects anxiety from social and religious norms. So you don't have to worry about your sin when you go to church. You know, gosh, don't be so anxious about that. It's not a big deal. It embraces anxiety from personal responsibility to choose. So there is anxiety because there's a moment where you choose something, ice cream or Disney movie, you know, picking flowers or skipping down the street. You choose something, and there's an anxiousness right there before you make the choice. So embrace that. It rejects the purpose to life, and it embraces a purposeless life. It rejects meaning to everything that we do, and it embraces meaningless everything. So everything is just completely meaningless. It rejects despair, and it embraces despair is the beginning to life. So you have to face your despair in order to really freely live. It rejects objective meaning, objective truth, objective morals, and it embraces creating meaning, creating truth, creating morals. It rejects hope that follows from meaning. It says there is no, you don't get hope from meaning like Christians think. You get hope from no meaning. You only get hope from meaninglessness. You only get hope from facing your own meaninglessness. That's when you can create hope, create meaning, create truths, create morality. So you're starting to get a picture, I think, right? Yeah, let's take a couple questions and we'll keep going here. Yes, sir.
What you're saying doesn't sound like choosing. It sounds like random selection. The guy comes in with the bomb to blow everybody up. He just makes a random selection. If you want to make a choice, you have to know what all your choices are. You can't just say it's between two things.
Well, I think something that even makes your point more powerful is that with what you're saying, that you can't make a decision on something to define your life and to create meaning for your life without already considering options. Yeah, well, okay, let me speak to both things here. So one thing I think is really powerful with what you're saying is that you're presupposing a meaningful world in order to make a meaningful decision.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one critique. We'll talk about that too later. This other thing is that for the existentialists, just to clarify their position, it's not that they're just randomly selecting stuff. They're creating themselves, their future selves. They're choosing things in some weird way, based on personality, instinct, preferences, whatever, to become a certain person, to be a certain way. It's really not random. They really have a desire to create themselves. We, right now, before we face our own absurdity, we have no essence. So we need to co-create what we are. That's the existentialist view. If you're non-Christian?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean...
Mm-hmm.
Yes. This view fits very well for the non-Christian. It's very easy for them to adopt this view. And most do unknowingly. That's why we hear those expressions somewhat often. Yeah.
There's some other movements that flow in this, and that is that in this process, you can choose whether or not to choose. Before you choose, you can choose whether or not to choose. I've been through this a million times in Japan. The people you got to deal with, they've actually decided whether or not to decide. They haven't decided about what they're going to do. So choosing to make a choice is the prior elective. And then you have, by virtue of what you said, you have the existentialist mentality, which is narcissistic, and it moves to a conclusion by fiat. Okay? Not predicated on anything other than the fact that you say it is. Okay? I say it is, and therefore it is, and that's by fiat. There's no cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
That's right.
Is that true?
That is true.
That's true.
Their view. You get subjectivism. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, so relativism is the idea that because there are different moral values in different cultures and subcultures, and different ways they understand reality, because there are differences, there is no way to judge which one is correct. And so relativism doesn't necessarily say that they are both correct. It just says that no one can judge. Who are you to judge Aborigines doing this or that, or cannibalism in some tribe? Who are you to judge? Your culture is not better just because you're in the West with cool clothes and education. So because they're different, you can't judge them. Subjectivism says you create your own morals. He creates his own morals, she creates her own morals, and we all have different little loci of morality. Sometimes these moral boundaries, you know, bump into each other, but it just stops there. There doesn't go further than that. It just says, hey, we just create our own meaning, we create our own truth, we create our own morality. And that's all they say. They don't really take it the next step. Okay. Now, let's get into this first part, and then we'll take a break for just a few minutes, and we'll come back because we have a lot to talk about. So let's get into how did existentialism develop as a philosophy, and then after the break we'll bring in some critiques of it. So existential thinkers. So again, existentialism came as a response to nihilism and the mechanistic machine and economy that humans had found themselves in. So worldview professor James Sire, he says, indeed, existentialism's major interest is in our humanity and how we can be significant in an otherwise insignificant world. And then there's another quote I have for you here. So how does man cope with the human condition and being thrown into reality? This word thrown is used by Jean-Paul Sartre, that we are all just thrown into human existence out of the cosmos. How does man cope with this? Well, to avoid hopelessness, but not include God in the picture. We don't want any of that. He must have something else to cling to. What is that? Well, it turns out to be man himself, like Chris mentioned in the back. Okay, so some of this train of thought eventually morphed into secular humanism, like we talked about, but existentialism still remains at the heart of our culture today. Existentialism, again, is a response to nihilism. Nihilism concluded that without God in the universe and all the affairs of humanity, are completely meaningless. And so we criticized nihilism last week. We're not going to do that again. Some of those criticisms, though, again, if they attack nihilism, then existentialism doesn't have anything to stand on. But let's just take it for let's just give them the benefit of the doubt and go with this idea that, okay, you're basing your whole view on nihilism, which falls, like based on our critiques of last week, but let's just continue to entertain their view. So Albert Camus, he was an existentialist playwright and novelist. He wrote that he has sought to transcend nihilism. And essentially, this is the goal of existentialism. It's to transcend nihilism, to get past your despair, to get on the other side of the abyss. So if you're here and you finally decide to face your despair, and here's your gulf of nothingness that you have to finally peer into, once you start peering into that and you start developing and creating meaning and choosing yourself, and then you can get to the other side and you're a happy camper because you create meaning. You're kind of the enlightened one. But you have to go through this despair first. So he wanted to transcend it. He wanted to get past it. That was kind of the goal of it. And I don't know if you're picking up on this. You're getting Christian themes here. You have to accept that you're a sinner. You have to give it to God, this being beyond us, this transcendent being, and then you come out on the other side as someone who can do meaningful things. Yeah. So there's a little bit of an alternative worldview coming to play here. This is the first version of a worldview that gives us something, gives us morality. It gives us a theory of meaning and morality. Previously, we just have naturalism, which again, we critiqued and beat up and it fell away, but let's just give it the benefit of doubt. With naturalism and nihilism, you really don't have a theory of meaning and truth. Now you do. So how do we respond to that and say that our theory of meaning and truth is better as Christians? Because this is the alternative. So now they have a story, kind of like we do. The existentialist is looking to answer the nihilist and say, hey, there is actually a way to get meaning without God and morality without God. So that's kind of what I'm saying, is there's a way to not have God in the picture, but you still wind up with meaning and hope at the end of the day with no God. See, they now have the formula. Okay, so these existentialists, except for the first two, are pretty much all non-Christian. So Blaise Pascal, Soren Kierkegaard were Christian, and Pascal was a mathematician. You may remember some things in math that he did. Kierkegaard was a weird dude. We'll talk about him soon, but other than that, he kind of set the stage for secular existentialism with this Christian existentialism. Now, yeah. Pascal, yeah. So these guys all attempted to spell out the human condition without restraint and with brutal honesty. And when you read their stuff, I mean, they are passionate people, for philosophy kind of people. Those philosopher nerds, you know, these guys are like philosopher, like genius, fiery preachers, you know. They're the guys on TV that you're like, calm down, turn it quick before you know. Sometimes you just kind of catch those guys, they're like yelling at you, and you're in your living room like lying down, like, oh my God, like, kind of catches you off guard. But of course, they're probably preaching the word of God, so. I grew up in a church like that, by the way, so I can kind of diss on them. Let's see. So after World War II, existentialism was very much a flourishing movement. So because of World War II and the disillusionment that came from that we like to kill each other, we do this inequality thing, and we put each other in concentration camps, and the Soviet Union killing all these people. Everyone starts to get this sense of, oh my God, we really haven't progressed much at all. We really kind of, we blew it. What happened? I thought all this technology and these tanks and these planes and all these cool radars and all these submarines, they were really helping us become a more advanced people and an advanced person, but they didn't realize that all this exterior stuff really doesn't change us individually. It just gives that appearance, kind of like our cell phones today. We have a lot of power, don't we? We have a lot of knowledge. We have a lot of access. We can do a lot of stuff. We can be very productive. All the while, our being is still rusting and corroding away. In fact, it probably helps us lose track of where we are and how we process and who we're becoming, not just what we're doing. This illusion that technology brings, this illusion was kind of hit everybody in the face after World War II. And so the existentialists started writing away and carried culture with them into this existential subjectivist world that became very postmodern and relativistic. So they courageously led the charge, the dreadful charge, into the realms of death, nothingness, and absurdity by facing the implications of World War II, what man has become, what man can do to each other. And so one historian of existentialism says this, mid-century, for example, the existentialists helped popularize tenets of nihilism in their attempts to blunt its destructive potential. So they tried to say, nihilism's not that bad. We can morph it into this other thing. By the end of the century, existential despair as a response to nihilism gave way to an attitude of indifference, often associated with anti-foundationalism. Remember the word foundationalism? The idea that we have a knowledge structure based on foundations that need no other foundations. They are the base of our view. Well, with existentialism, you again take away the foundations. So anti-foundationalism is the framework of the existential postmodern and relativistic culture that we now find ourselves in, that there is no one truth that all cultures can adopt. There is no one meaning for humanity. There is no objective right or wrong anywhere in the universe. There's no foundation for that because there is no God. Now we find ourselves in this cultural swamp day to day. This is what we encounter, anti-foundationalism. So hopefully can see this kind of movement here through this spread and morphing of ideas. I have prepared a bunch of stuff for you on each existential thinker, but depending on how much you're going to party right now at the break, we may or may not be able to cover all of it. So we'll see. Why don't we take a 5-minute break, if you don't mind, and we'll come back. Thank you. So we kind of left off right before we talked about our first existentialist thinker. And we don't really have time to go into this brief discussion on each one, unfortunately. I'll do a couple highlights, though, if you don't mind, real quick. We'll start with Kierkegaard. He's often called the father of modern existentialism. Hold on real quick. Hey, are we recording in the back? Yeah, okay, awesome. Okay, so he's famous for saying something like this, truth is subjectivity. Truth is subjectivity. He wrote a book, Fear and Trembling, where he talked about how Abraham, when faced with the decision to kill Isaac, was going through this existential dread. And he went and discussed this for about 100 pages, about this moment when Abraham had to kill Isaac. And what was it like to follow God's objective principles? Because God told him to do so, he needed to do it. But really, should he? It's his son, you know. This is an unprecedented command of God. So Abraham was experiencing this angst and this anxiousness. What anxiety, what should he do? So this is what Kierkegaard is kind of famous for, and a bunch of other things. He really was into individualism. The church in Holland at the time was very much Lutheran and very dry, and so he tried to encourage Christians to rise up and be alive. He really wanted everyone to be alive. So there's a lot of passionate language to not have this dead church lifestyle in the Lutheran church in Holland. Yeah. He was also famous for talking about blind faith and making the leap of faith. And this is the view that most Christians adopt when it comes to faith. It's really not a biblical view. If you are a person in here that says, we all, when we become Christians, we all need to take a leap of faith and just believe in the unknown with no evidence for it, you are essentially regurgitating Kierkegaard. This is not a biblical view of faith. There's no leap of faith in the Bible or any notion of such. There is faith based on evidence. So consider that. Kierkegaard is very famous for leap of faith, blind faith, and when we talk about faith, we usually think of it in blind faith, as blind faith, but in reality, we need to think of it in the future as seeing faith, not blind faith, seeing faith, because this is biblical faith. And consider that. But Kierkegaard kind of did us an injustice with this because it really did affect Western culture, Christian culture. And again, this comes into play when people are now hearing this gospel message presented to them. They have to then make this subjective decision. And it's all about themselves with no objective reality out there, like Jesus was ever really a person. They just say, oh, Jesus sounds like a good leprechaun, unicorn-type mermaid figure. Let's just kind of believe in him. I'll have a good life, make the altar call, and boom, I'm a happy camper. So this kind of comes from Kierkegaard. So we got to be very careful in our gospel presentations from the pulpit and on the street corner to not use the words blind faith and leap of faith, please. All right. Dostoevsky. Am I saying that right? Dostoevsky. He was a famous Russian novelist in the latter part of the 19th century who wanted to combat the Enlightenment project. He fought in his writings against the rationalism that we talked about, the empiricism that we talked about, the skepticism of the Enlightenment, and wanted everybody to get back to individuality. Again, like Kierkegaard, individuality. The theme comes up again. And to rise up against the machine of culture. We don't have time to go through that much, but Nietzsche. We talked about Nietzsche last week. His influence on the existential movement cannot be understated. He is more of a pre-thinker to the movement, but kind of existentialist in a sense. He again talked about individualism. That's kind of his goal. It's to rise against institutions, government, society, and religion. So Nietzsche was very passionate as well. According to Nietzsche, people fear the independence that comes with being a cultural rebel. And because people love convention and tradition, they just stick to that, and they never rise above and rise against the machine. This is kind of Nietzsche. And he then later on talked about the Uberman hero, Superman. You may have been familiar with this coming from Nietzsche, Uberman, Superman, Uberman being the German word. It's a very a powerful word. It's hard to describe. The idea, though, is with Nietzsche is that he wants us all to live dangerously, to rise against convention, and be an individual. And this takes an act of courage, kind of like what we've been talking about. It takes an act of courage to do this, to go against culture and create your own meaning. So that's kind of Nietzsche. I'm just like, I mean, these guys wrote volumes of stuff, so how can you summarize in a couple sentences? Albert Camus, he was a French existential novelist, playwright after World War II. Believe it or not, he did his PhD on St. Augustine, who is pretty much the most brilliant Christian to ever have lived. And so Camus, being a non-Christian, studied Augustine and wrote his dissertation, his doctrinal dissertation, on St. Augustine's works. Very smart guy, intriguing figure. Believe it or not, later on, Camus almost became a Christian. He died around 50 years old. It was an unexpected death in a car accident in France, I believe. And he was on his way to spend the summer with his wife and children. And in the previous summer, though, he had been in contact with a priest in France who had been talking to him about baptism, salvation, and Camus actually talked about how he had been going to church and how he's actually interested in becoming a Christian, and but not really ready because he was already had this atheist position in society and was known for his novels already. So he had to kind of really let that go. So it took the priest and him, said, well, maybe next summer, and he wound up dying maybe in February or something. So it's kind of a tragic death, but pretty interesting that this guy almost became a Christian. He wrote this awesome novel called The Stranger. Very strange novel. Until the end, it doesn't really get interesting. But he kind of said that this guy who was about to be executed for murder, he was discussing things with the jail chaplain. And the chaplain was trying to talk to him about God. And the character who is about to die in the morning, you know, how it was having this moment of existential despair and dread and the absurdity of existence and how it's all, you know, worthless and meaningless. And he was going to die and everybody's going to die. But then he realized that if he embraced his death, that act of embracing was an action, and because he was creating meaning in that moment, then he basically said that this is very attractive to create meaning in this moment of despair, in the face of my execution in the morning. So it's more attractive to live this way. It brings more life and energy to me to live this way, because I know, you know, I can overcome it, so to speak, based on my attitude. And so this is better than Christianity, because he was able to find meaning and hope in hopelessness and meaninglessness. And so the idea was that Christians live with like a false hope and a meaning that's just illusory, but the non-Christian existentialist lives with something that is more powerful, because it's meaning in the face of meaninglessness. So that was kind of Camus' thing with the book The Stranger. Now, Jean-Paul Sartre, there's many ways to say his last name. Let's just go with that one for now. Sartre's very famous for saying existence precedes essence. We mentioned this at the beginning part. Now, with classical Christianity, we say essence precedes existence. What do we mean by that? We mean that we all carry around with us a human essence. It's called human nature, which was given to us by God. We were created with the image of God. So the image of God is our human essence. So we say that our existence, our individuality, stems from our essence. And in philosophy, when you talk about essence versus, say, properties, this is a very normal thing you encounter in philosophy. So with philosophy, talking about metaphysics, we talked a little bit about that, ontology, you have an essence, let's just say this is the essence, and then there are primary properties of things. You probably can't see this in the back, but it says primary properties that are in part of the essence or somehow intertwine with the essence. So let's just say there's these primary properties like God. Okay, let's say this is God, and his primary property is love and truth and light. Okay, and whereas accidental properties are kind of out here, or secondary, primary and secondary, or necessary and accidental, primary, secondary, necessary, accidental, kind of the same idea, where God has accidental properties like his willingness to do something. So a decision, maybe a decision based on us praying, may be an accidental thing. It's things that aren't primary to his nature, aren't necessary. They can be conveyed differently depending on the situation, let's say. Now, interestingly, God's essence is his existence, and God's existence is his essence. But we, as products of God, so to speak, our being is derived from his being. So with God, we get humans who have, let's say, little being with a little b, and we have an essence too, and our essence is derived from his. His gives us meaning, and our individuality meaning. And so what the existentialist is trying to do is they're trying to say that there is no essence to humans. There's just individuality. There's just billions of us with no essence. There's no connection here, because this doesn't even exist if you're a secular existentialist. But what they're doing is they're eliminating the connection between God and man, and they're saying there is no predetermined essence. We're just human beings. That's what they mean when they say existence precedes essence. It means that we just exist, but there is no essence. Whereas in Christianity, essence precedes existence. Our essence is derived from his being, and therefore our existence, our individuality, our personality comes from the essence, the image of God implanted in us. So Jean-Paul Sartre is very famous for saying existence precedes essence with existentialism, because it reverses the Christian understanding of man. And right now, when we're talking about homosexuality and the homosexual agenda, we are and abortion and everything, we are talking about what it is to be human. What is our nature? What is our essence? Do we have one or not? That is where it goes to. Because if we don't have one, we don't have meaning, we don't have value, we don't have purpose. So it's okay to get rid of this. It's okay to annihilate this by government fiat if we want. So this is very important, this idea that existence precedes essence, because it affects our culture and even legislation today. So that's the idea, is that Sartre's atheistic existentialism presupposes that God does not exist, and with no God and with man existing prior to any conception of himself, man is not predefined and therefore not predetermined. So if there's no predefinition of what man is from God, then he's not predetermined to be a certain way anyway. He can choose himself, choose his existence, choose what he will become. That's the idea with existence precedes essence. Now, with morality and freedom, we could talk about this for a little while, but I think you're kind of getting the picture already. You can see that little quote there at the bottom of Sartre's Freedom, that little portion. It says, "We invent values. Life has no meaning a priori. It's up to you to give it meaning." Remember we talked about the word a priori and a posteriori? It's coming up again. So with Sartre, we invent values just like we invent a little mechanism or a smartphone. We invent them. We just conjure them up. And it's up to you to give life meaning. So that's the idea with these thinkers. They are very deep, very passionate. They all express existentialism a little differently. But again, the core themes that we talked about at the first part are common through all these thinkers. And then we'll look at this, the implications here. There's a question in the back. I would go through this sort of stuff, to be honest. But at the end, we're going to talk about kind of how to engage with some of these ideas, practically speaking. Hopefully we'll have time. It's in the notes if we don't. But you really got to ask the questions first. I mean, that's at the core of everything, is really get them to open up. But we got to break it down to the basis of their worldview and the absurdity of where their worldview leads. And if the basis of their worldview, nihilism, is super flawed, and naturalism is super flawed and self-refuting, and if their worldview leads to absurdity, then there's a real problem with that worldview. So we try to show the beginning and the end to be problematic. Yes?
Your argument will always have a context. They're never non-contextual. Because then they have nothing to move to or to move from. And so oftentimes in really tough cases, they'll have an attitude that it's attributable to non-attributability. it's attributable to nothing. And so non-attributes are the context. So it's antithetical, but they end up getting caught up in trying to define a context that they can continue to move with and through. They never are non-contextual, even if they assert that it's by fiat, it's still by their own fiat.
Yeah.
So you have to come, how did you come to that position? It's just easier to buy a mice cream.
Yeah. So this... No, this is really good. I mean, we need to be relational and understand people's context, because even the existentialist, like you said, Roger, is going to have this context of his life. You know, he's going to be coming off of, you know, his wife cheating on him, or, you know, he just got a promotion at his job. You know, he's going to have some sort of situation. And we have to understand that before we can get to some of the stuff. People usually aren't going to let us critique their worldview or ask them questions so they can critique their own worldview unless they are comfortable with us. There has to be trust. And so you've been building this relationship just like Roger's talking about, and that's very good because you used a good question. It was insightful. She started to say something. Oh, well, blah, blah, blah. Wait. Oh, I don't know. You know, this is great. This is where we want people to be. I don't know. Tell me.
Yeah.
So this is great. Good question, Chris. Okay, let's look at this. What are the implications of existentialism? Well, like we've been talking about, despair and absurdity will actually continue if one doesn't act against it. So if one doesn't face his despair and absurdity, it will just continue on. So that's the implication of existentialism, and that's no good. Life is meaningful only if one invents meaning. Okay, so that's no good either. I mean, we want life to be meaningful just because it's meaningful. Another implication is that extreme secular humanism arises from this view. We kind of talked about that a little bit. And secular humanism has its own problems, like we'll see with this other set of notes. Western individualism, this I-centered universe arises from this view. We all know what this is talking about, this I-centered universe. We are the center of the universe, you know. We all are our own centers. And we think we're the center of the actual universe. So that's Western individualism. Of course, none of us struggle with that in here. Moral subjectivism is supported on this view, like we've been talking about with this, how this leads to moral subjectivism, that meaning is created by the individual and morality is created by the individual. And then preservation of humanity becomes a primary goal here. So with this view, humans and humanity becomes of incredible interest. And we then need to become a people that will preserve humanity, because that's really what it's all about. So interestingly, we see humanity again rising on the pedestal of importance with the 20th century progressing. Humanity becomes very important. All right, so we have these criticisms of the view. It's nearing 8:45. We're getting close there. Who's ready to pack up and go home right now? Nobody. Yay. Awesome. Okay. So since you said that, yeah. Well, if we close up about 11:45, is that okay?
Wake me up.
Right. We'll hang out with you. Okay, so some of the criticism, real quick, of this view, you can probably already tell that there are some mega issues, but just to throw out a few. When you say to an existentialist or a subjectivist, hey, there are objective morals in the universe, they then say, oh, really? There are? Because if there is one, then I've got a problem, because I think there are none. So if we can just show there is one objective moral command or duty or moral structure, then we already have refuted their view, because their view says, no, you create morality. There's nothing out there. So we can say that meaning, what I mean by this is that moral laws are discovered and exist regardless of whether or not anybody believes in them. So when we're talking about objective morality, that's what we're saying. We're saying there is an objective moral truth out there that exists, even if there are no humans around to think about them or believe in them. Even if you stop thinking about it and you fall asleep, it's still there. In other words, if I go take some money out of Veronica's purse and steal her car keys and then go crash her car, and then I go take her credit card and spend all her money on Vegas, and then I say, hey, you know, no big deal, right? You know, this is morally wrong, okay? If I go and, you know, go beat up one of Dan's family members, let's say, and beat them to death, you know, he's going to say that's morally wrong. There are some things that are objectively wrong in the universe, regardless of whether or not anybody thinks about them. That's the idea with objective morality. And anybody that says, no, there is no objective morals, just go steal their stereo out of their car. Or go keep them up all night and torture them with light and spraying them with water in their face, you know, so they can't sleep for 4 days. They're going to say, this is wrong, stop, you know. So if you can find that there's one objective moral out there, then you've already disproved subjectivism. I'm hesitant to say continue there because I don't know if I'll have time to finish. But what were you thinking here? Yeah, I think with them, you're getting at a good point. It's that they don't think it through all the way, you know, because they're going to say, I'm just acting out of what I want to do to become the person I want to become. And so if that imposes on you, oh well, until you say, well, I want to impose on you my fist in your face, you know, something like that. So then they're going to say, oh, you can't do that. So then we start saying, well, who's got the right answer? Who's morally right and who's morally wrong? You both are.
Well, Kierkegaard brought this up, talking about the Nazi.
Mm-hmm.
The I am.
Yeah.
Relative to the act in me.
Yeah.
And they ended up not being able to move away from that premise.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
It was that.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. This speaks to what we're talking about in the sense that when two individuals' being and decisions start overlapping, then we start to encounter this conflict of interest. Yeah. And that's a good example of when two subjectivists disagree on something, what are they disagreeing about? They're disagreeing about the other guy's behavior not conforming to a moral standard somewhere. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a disagreement. They would let each other steal their stuff and torture each other and beat up their family members, and they wouldn't disagree with that behavior. But because there's a disagreement, they are appealing to something implied in the disagreement that says, no, you are not conforming to the highest or the standard that's out there. Yeah, so that's interesting. That's another way to show with relativism that objective morals exist, is to show that moral disagreements, when people are studying and thinking and discussing cultures, it brings up the idea that the disagreement is implying this objective standard that these people are or are not complying with. Yeah, so interestingly, moral disagreements are a good argument against relativism, which is the next point on this list, that arguments against relativistic morality succeed. So when you're talking about relativism and you're trying to refute it, and subjectivism in the same way you're trying to refute it, these arguments against it are very much successful. So really, but pretty much all philosophers in academia are not moral relativists. Their students are, because their students don't know any better. But until you start refuting subjectivism and relativism, they're going to maintain that position unknowingly, that it's just not a successful position. So objective truths are self-evident. There are some self-evident truths out there, like killing babies for the fun of it is morally wrong, regardless of what culture we're in or what planet we're on. So we know that there are some self-evident truths out there. So the burden of proof is on the relativist when it comes to these innate truths. We've been talking about innate ideas, things that we can know without observation, without experience of reality. These are innate ideas. And so subjectivism as a result or basis for a worldview is simply incorrect in a universe of objective morals. So we have acknowledged that there are objective morals in the universe, and they impose on us, and we create laws with them, and justice systems with them, and so someone who just continues in their subjectivism is just living a lie, because he's essentially saying there are no objective morals, even though everybody knows that there are. So subjectivism just doesn't work in a world with objective morality. So the other thing we could say is that there is, in fact, inherent value in the universe. Humans have an intrinsic value. The earth, the plants, and animals have intrinsic value. They are valuable to some degree, right? Like if I came up to Phil and I said, Phil, hey, there's a creature behind you, will you please kill it? Your response should be, what is it? If I said, it's just a little toddler, a 3-year-old kid named Adam, go ahead and just do like this with a knife, please. Put us all out of our misery, you know, something absurd like that. Or if I said, oh, it's a cockroach. It's like, oh, okay, you kill it. What a thing is, it speaks to its value. And we all recognize this. So there is intrinsic value in the universe if we just stop and think about it. Now, the next thing we could say, and we'll wrap this up here, is that subjectively choosing the good doesn't achieve morality. So the subjectivist says, whatever I choose becomes the good. Okay? So James Sire, he says, affirmation is not enough. It can be countered by an opposite affirmation. So if I say, this church building is good, and you bring in some other architect, structural engineer, he says, no, this church building is bad, well, then you have two opposing opinions on the matter. So just because I choose something doesn't actually give it goodness. And that's what subjectivism, says. It says that when I choose something, I put value, I ascribe value to that thing, and someone else could come along and say, no, it's bad, so then you are automatically have two people ascribing value to something. So there must be one value that is right. Is it good or is it bad? Because if we are both ascribing different types or levels of value to the same thing, one of us must be wrong. This is called the law of non-contradiction in philosophy. It's been around since forever, and even secular philosophers understand that A is not B, A is A, and because A is not B, we cannot say that A is B. It's pretty simple, law of non-contradiction. William Lane Craig says about Sartre, he says, Sartre's program is actually an exercise in self-delusion, for the universe doesn't really acquire meaning just because I happen to give it one. So just because I say this chair has value doesn't mean the chair has value. We cannot ascribe value to something. It either has intrinsic value or it doesn't. And human fetus has intrinsic value whether or not the mother thinks it does. There's objective value to the human fetus whether or not the mother thinks there is. So objective reality still imposes on us. In a sense, the moral world imposes on us, just like the nihilist and existentialist says the natural world of death and decay imposes on us. Objective morality does too. And when we see excessive evil being conducted, we know with certainty that this action is morally disgusting. And everything in us calls for it to end. We have this instinctive drive to stop evil. When we hear about sex slavery and how rampant it is across the world today, we are in shock and we want to stop it immediately. Everything in us calls for it to end. That sort of call is another evidence for objective morality. James Sire says, it fails to provide, talking about subjectivism, it fails to provide a referent for a morality that goes beyond the individual. So subjectivism does not allow the individual to consider another standard outside of himself. And at the end of the day, we really do need something to refresh us from the what I call the stinky funk of ourselves. Okay, this is something that when we just sit around and think about ourselves and talk about humanity and humanism and how great humans are, we just wind up getting this incestual stinky funk happening. And that's what happens in a world without God when people start theorizing about what it's like to have a moral structure with no God. When I give value to something and you give it a different value, no one is right, like we talked about a moment ago. In terms of this subjective individualism, James Sire points out that many would say that it is not to go beyond nihilism at all. It is only to don a mask called value, a mask stripped clean away by death. So Sire is saying that everybody that's an existentialist is still just a nihilist, because when they die, they leave behind a world that they ascribed value to in different ways, shapes, and forms that really is meaninglessness. That meaningless value they ascribed, it goes to the grave with them. It's annihilated just like they are. So in reality, every existentialist is a closet nihilist. He's just putting the mask on, saying that I can create meaning in the world, but he really can't, because when he dies, whatever he said was meaningful, according to his view, isn't really meaningful, and that ascription that he provided goes to the grave with him. It ends. So looking back in the world that we all still here in, saying, hey, that existentialist just provided meaning to that chair and this wall and everything, the American flag, whatever. Well, he died, so I guess those things don't have the meaning he said he had anymore, because I'm going to give it a different meaning, and my meaning now stands. So in other words, Sire is saying that he's just wearing a mask, but in reality, his meaning goes to the grave, so everything is meaningless, just like nihilism says. So therefore, his view suffers from the same conclusions nihilism does that we saw last week. And William Lane Craig says this, Sartre is really saying, let's pretend the universe has meaning, and this is just fooling ourselves. So Craig is pointing out, like, look, these guys are just making up stuff. If you say that the world has meaning, let's just pretend it has meaning. That's all they're doing. And this is just fooling ourselves. In reality, you can't just say you're going to give meaning to the world. It either does or doesn't have meaning. You don't give it meaning. That means nothing. So, in other words, objective morality is the case, and telling everyone else that subjectivism is what you're doing and how you're ascribing meaning, it doesn't work. Okay, so lastly, well, I won't go through these, but I'll just say these main points, that even atheist philosophers accept objective morals, meaning and value and purpose in the universe. So if you actually go through and talk to some atheistic philosophers, you sit down and have a chat with them over dinner, they will actually confirm objective morals to you. In fact, many of these authors, although they are non-Christian, and although they say there is no objective meaning and value in the universe, they actually do speak as if there is. They actually say that there are objective morals. In fact, Richard Dawkins, Bertrand Russell, some of these new atheists, Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, when they write, they actually say that, hey, Christians imposing their worldview is wrong. So they're actually saying that when we go share the gospel, we're doing something morally wrong. But what are they doing? They're appealing to an objective standard out there that's saying, hey, we're not complying with that standard of not imposing your view on people. So, in other words, they're refuting their own position, because they are elsewhere saying that you create meaning, you create morality. So they're contradicting their view. And of course, that's not what we're doing when we go share the gospel. We don't impose things on anybody. Okay, and lastly, it's impossible to live without assuming objective morals, meaning, and value in the universe. You just can't live this way. You just can't. You don't have a society. You don't have friendship. You don't have family. You don't have any social structures if we all don't agree that there are objective meaning morals in the universe, and we all try to live to them. And then there's a few other points here that I think are amazing, but we don't have time for. C.S. Lewis did a great critique on existentialism and humanism, although he didn't call it a critique on existentialism and humanism. And I have a supplement document that I want to email you tonight that will allow you to just kind of skim through some of what Lewis was doing with his book, The Abolition of Man. The Abolition of Man is considered one of the best books of the entire last 100 years. And it's a little book that Lewis wrote. And it's actually taken from his, I think, some lectures at Oxford. And so it's a very important book in the history of Christian thought. So we can conclude that, does existentialism stand up to scrutiny? No, definitely not. Surprise, surprise. And then here, what are the sound Christian responses to these comments rooted in existentialism? We've kind of talked through these, but we'll just go through 1, 2, 3, 4 here. Is that show that the need that we all have for meaning, and at the end of the day, we all must face our deaths. Okay, so what happens when you face your death and I face my death? Let's talk about that. We all have a need for meaning, by the way. You have a need for meaning in your life. I do too. It's something we naturally all have. And we could all talk about how we, Christian or non-Christian, we all seek meaning. Show the logical conclusion of their view and the criticisms of it, just like we've been talking about. And then point out that the non-Christian lacks a foundation for his values. Where do you, Mr. Non-Christian, get a foundation for your, what you call objective values? What you agree with me on when we talk about killing babies for the fun of it is morally wrong. What foundation do you have? My foundation is right here, is God. But what grounds your moral system? And nothing does. They do not have a foundation for objective morality, and they must agree that it exists based on the criticisms above. So now we're showing that they don't even have a way to account for objective morality in their overall worldview. And then finally, we show that the Christian worldview does have a foundation for objective moral values. It's rooted in God's very nature, and it's rooted in God's very essence. And this worldview then rises to the top and looks very attractive. So with that in mind, these are some good ways to hopefully go through conversations and think about their worldview, and consider some of these things when you are encountering some of these ideas on creating meaning outside of a meaningless universe when you talk to people. Let's go ahead and close, and I'll take other questions up front and after. Sorry. Father, we thank you so much for tonight and the idea of you being our ultimate source of meaning and morality. We thank you that we have a worldview that is cohesive, coherent, and it's so beneficial to how we live our day-to-day life, that we have a grounding for our moral structures. And we pray that you would help us to encourage others towards this worldview, help us to build relationships with our friends and family and people that we encounter, so that we can really dive into some of these topics, really understand where they're coming from, and talk through some of these existential questions. And Lord, we pray that you would help us and guide us in those conversations, God, that you would prepare the people that we encounter for you. And ultimately, God, they would come face to face with you, Jesus. So we thank you, Lord, and we pray that you would bless us this week and weekend as we go. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, we'll see you next week.